course. We'll be speaking much more in the future about this great man. I think, you know, for all time to come. I mean, this was a personality beyond time. How can I put it? You know, I don't have the words even to express that as far as Imam Khomeini is concerned. May God bless his soul. But thanks once again, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, for being on the program.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And it just leaves me to say for our listeners, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I hope you benefited from the program. May God's mercy and his blessings be upon you all. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
The Light.
The pandemic has not stopped this British musician from holding live concerts. His audience is a very special group in Danish rural areas. Jacob Shaw, a university professor, is the man behind this experiment. He says playing for the animals has been his second best option after the pandemic forced the cancellation of many events and social gatherings. Shaw says the performance for the cows has been so rewarding that he wants to continue it even after public spaces are reopened. He says the cows seem to enjoy classical music very much.
They react differently to different pieces. We played something that was slightly more upbeat, a little bit more modern, and a lot of them didn't like it and they went away. And I think that the type of pieces which is closer to their voice, closer to their mooing, which could be similar actually to a cello, which is why it's so successful with them, they prefer that.
The cello player is sometimes accompanied by other musicians. They say the experience has helped them practice and also relieve some of the stress of a live concert.
Science fiction has turned into reality, or at least that's how the developer of Aircar describes his vehicle when it transforms from a car into an aircraft in less than 3 minutes. This prototype flying car was designed and created by Slovakian transportation professor Stefan Klein. He says that his design opens a new category in transportation. The dual-mode vehicle composed a 35-minute flight in this week between the two Slovakian airports. So far, it has completed more than 40 hours of test flight. Aircar can fly about 1,000 kilometers at a height of over 2,500 meters. That makes the dream of those who wish to ride above traffic closer to reality. A digital art museum in the Japanese capital has unveiled a stunning exhibition offering visitors an intimate interaction with nature. One of the attractions of the show is Floating Flower Garden, which is a mirrored room filled with 13,000 orchid flowers. The orchids are dangling from the ceiling and move up once a visitor walks through in the space and approaches the flowers. Once the visitors move past, the flowers descend again. This makes the visitors able to freely wander around the three-dimensional flower mass space. Tokyo-based digital art group Team Lab that runs this exhibition says the artwork is designed to help people think that they are part of the garden.
This is an installation filled with these flowers. As you walk towards them, the flowers slowly move up to create an area of space for you. Surrounded so completely by flowers, you feel immersed in the flowers, the garden itself.
There are several other installations in this exhibition. One is an outdoor piece filled with Ovid sculptures that light up after the sun sets. Visitors can see 61 different colors of light in this section. When one of the Ovids tipped over by a hand or the wind, it emits a sound. The sound is then echoed by the surrounding Ovids. In a school in the Ukrainian capital, kids learn about saving the environment and helping those in need through a creative way. Students put plastic bottles in a machine as currency. Then they can select what they would like to spend money on. Buying food for stray animals and donating to children with special needs are some of the choices. The project was first launched in a mall in Kiev a few months ago. Afterwards, the designers found out that children were the most frequent users of this machine.
A child drops a bottle inside and sees an immediate result. It brings joy and happiness, and everyone is excited and wants the project to thrive.
The founders seek to install more and more machines in schools across Ukraine to raise environmental awareness among younger generations. Since the start of the project in October last year, over 5 tons of plastic has been collected from 6 machines.
India is known not only for its cultural diversity, but also for a vibrant assortment of uncountable dishes. Butter chicken is the only one delight you wouldn't like to miss while visiting Indian restaurants, especially if it is prepared by a celebrity chef like Saransh Koila. Koila's coal-fired oven is now sending a mouth-watering scent through India's commercial hub Mumbai as the young chef takes a break from COVID-19 relief efforts and resumes work. He is the one who established the first global butter chicken brand and authored the acclaimed food travelogue, India on My Platter. But with the coronavirus forcing people into isolation, his networks were also hit. So Goyla launched a non-profit platform called COVID Meals for India in April to connect thousands of volunteer home cooks and frontline workers.
The pandemic had a large impact on our business. Having said that, Goyla Butter Chicken, from the start, was always focused on deliveries and takeaway. So in that sense, our loss of revenue and a loss of business was slightly lesser than an average restaurant. But a lot of my friends, restaurateurs who are in this industry, have gone through an extremely tough time. The pandemic has taken its toll on our industry, and I think it has set us back by at least a couple of years.
Koila found his calling early, winning a televised cooking competition at the age of 25, which led him to host a travel program showcasing regional Indian cuisine. His profile exploded in 2018 when he was invited by former MasterChef Australia judge George Kalambaris to be a guest on the hit show, with contestants asked to recreate his signature dish.
Graduation is an exciting moment for all schoolgoers, but the occasion turns more joyful if it ends with a celebration like Scarlet Sales Festival, which is held in St. Petersburg in Russia at the end of the school year. The annual event is part of the famous White Nights Festival, traditionally held in summer, with spectacular fireworks, numerous music concerts, and a massive water show. Normally, thousands of domestic and foreign tourists flock to the city to watch the colorful event. But this year, the COVID-19 pandemic limited the number of the attendees. The festival began in the 1960s when several Russian schools united to celebrate the end of the academic year. That is in connection with the symbolism of the popular 1922 children's book, Scarlet Sails, by Alexander Grimm. Indonesia is dealing with a surge in coronavirus infections, but that has not stopped the people from observing the Yatnya Kasada Festival. Thousands of people braved the climb to the summit of Mount Bromo in eastern Java province to observe the ancient ritual. They made offerings ranging from fruits and crops to livestock by throwing the items to the pit of an active volcano. They believe the practice brings blessings and plenitude and helps them express gratitude for what they have. This year's festival was overshadowed by the coronavirus pandemic, with participants required to adhere to strict health protocols. China's space agency has released videos of its first Mars rover as it's exploring the red planet's surface. The rover is named Zhurong. It's now investigating a vast plane known as Utopia Planitia on Mars's northern hemisphere. The rover successfully landed on Mars in mid-May. It is studying the red planet's surface rocks and atmosphere. It also looks for signs of life, including any subsurface water or ice. The solar-powered Chinese robot weighs around 240 kilograms and has 6 wheels. China is the second country after the U.S. to operate a rover on Mars. A university in the Venezuelan capital Caracas has turned its roof into a garden and uses sustainable energy to light up its classes. The roof of Andres Bello Catholic University is covered with plants and 30 solar panels. The panels, along with a wind turbine, produced the 7,400 watts of electricity to illuminate that area and light 2 rooms in the building. The roof is now functioning as a self-sufficient and environmentally friendly open-air classroom. The proposal for the project was put forward by 2 students. The aim is to educate people about renewable energy and the threat of climate change.
A small New Hampshire town has been hit by a series of car break-ins over the last few weeks. People were shocked when they finally discovered the mischievous criminal. A large black bear has been identified as the bandit wreaking havoc in the town of Thornton. The naughty mammal was caught on camera as it got on its 2 hind legs and skillfully opened the door of a car. Police say the bear was most likely rummaging for food. Authorities have asked people to remove food from their cars to avoid enticing the troublesome animal. A Jordanian woman is receiving high demands for the soap she produces. Why? Because she uses an unusual ingredient. Lara Altiti makes soap out of camel milk. She tours different cities in Jordan to find the best camel farms for her business. Titi uses camel milk as the major ingredient for the soap she produces. That's because she says it has rich benefits and contains more vitamins than cow milks.
The first stage includes weighing the soap, and I include different kinds of oil to preserve the quality of the soap and its therapeutic benefit. We need to have high foam and tough consistency, and we don't want it to be rancid. We place high importance on the therapeutic material that we add during the production process.
Titi started her soap line at home using a manual process and then expanded it to an independent workshop. Her soap line has now become very popular in Jordan. Titi produces more than 4,000 soap bars a month. She sells them both to domestic and international customers.
you're a car lover, this story is for you. Over 300 classic vehicles have taken part in a retro rally across Estonia. The 1,000-kilometer rally kicked off in the town of Perde. It drew participants from Latvia and Finland. Their motto is Straight Ahead to the Past. The vintage cars participated in the event are mostly produced between 1930 and 1980. Experts say all the vehicles are in good condition. However, they doubt if all the vehicles can make it to the end of the five-day rally.
German firm's electric air taxi takes its first flight at a show in an airport near the French capital, Paris. Volocopter's flying taxi, which looks like a tiny helicopter, took off and landed vertically over the airport with no passenger on board during a three-minute trial. Aside from its two-passenger capacity, the aircraft also has some room for luggage. It flew a 500-meter route at speeds of up to 30 kilometers per hour and 30 meters high along the airfield. The flying taxi service would first be operated by a licensed pilot, but the flight would be fully automated over a period of time.
With respect to regulation, initially we will have a fully certified, fully licensed helicopter pilot, just to fit into existing regulation. But we believe over time it can be much simpler to obtain such an operating license for a volocopter. And of course, in the last instance, we want to take a pilot requirement out and we want these vehicles to fly fully automated. So you will not need a pilot license anymore. You can just summon the volocopter, it will come and pick you up and bring you safely to your destination.
The German firm is entering the urban mobility market with high hopes of playing a major role in the infant industry. Volocopter says its objective is to have a service in operation for 2024 for the 2024 Olympic Games. Walking around the city without shoes can be delightful. If you're interested in the experience, visit the Russian capital. A 3.5-kilometer long barefoot trail has recently opened in Moscow's Elk Island Park. It's made of various materials such as pine bark, beach pebbles, and clay. Taking around 40 minutes to complete, the path attracts hundreds of visitors every day. However, some people find it difficult to walk without shoes, calling the path a torture trail. A zoo in Turkey has welcomed a baby elephant from an endangered species. The birth of a female calf at Izmir Wildlife Park has caused excitement in keepers and visitors. The calf, yet to be named, is the third offspring of parents from Asian species. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature classifies the Asian elephant as endangered due to their rapid decline in the wild. The Asian elephants are primarily threatened by poaching, fragmentation, and loss and degradation of habitat. Currently, around 20 to 40,000 Asian elephants are living across the world, five of which inhabiting Turkey's Izmir Zoo.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
European officials and human rights groups warned the UK's right-wing government is on the brink of violating the Geneva Conventions if it follows through with a plan to open up an offshore hub where refugees will be sent if they attempt to enter the country. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julia Conley Ryder. This article is published under the heading UK Ways Shockingly Cruel Plan to Detain Refugees in Offshore Holding Centers. Stay tuned for more. European officials and human rights groups warned the UK's right-wing government is on the brink of violating the Geneva Conventions if it follows through with a plan to open an offshore hub where refugees will be sent if they attempt to enter the country. Home Secretary Priti Patel plans to introduce the Nationality and Borders Bill, seeking to enable the government to send asylum seekers to an offshore location in Africa for processing. The Home Office is reportedly in talks with Danish officials regarding possibly sharing a processing center following the passage of a similar law in Denmark this month. Hjalva Johansson, the European Commissioner for Home Affairs, said in a statement after Denmark passed its law that the system aiming for external processes outside the EU instead of protecting the right to apply for asylum in the EU would send a strong and wrong signal to the outer world. The planned British legislation is designed as a deterrent for refugees who try to travel to the UK, according to inews.co.uk, and will involve deporting people who enter Britain without the right paperwork to the European countries through which they traveled. Amnesty International UK called Patel's planned legislation an unworkable attempt to avoid the country's duty to refugees under international law and a shockingly cruel approach to people seeking asylum. The UK receives very few people seeking asylum, and yet the government continues this utterly reckless discussion about finding another country to carry out its responsibilities, said Tom Davis, the organization's refugees campaign manager, adding, if true, this move would be extremely damaging and will give a green light to other countries to also shirk their responsibility. The non-profit advocacy group Refugee Council called the offshore processing scheme an act of cruel and brutal hostility towards vulnerable people. Through no fault of their own, they have had to flee war, oppression, and terror, said the group, which supports thousands of refugees in the UK each year with legal advice, mental health counseling, and integration into their new communities. Prime Minister Boris Johnson's government has decried the country's so-called refugee crisis despite receiving far fewer asylum applications than other European countries like France and Germany and being home to only about 1% of the world's refugees. Johnson is reportedly supportive of Patel's plan after about 5,600 asylum seekers crossed the English Channel so far this year. In February, journalist Andrew Connolly wrote at Foreign Policy that Patel and Johnson have sought to create a refugee crisis in the absence of an actual problem for the benefit of the right-wing press and government. Faced with a modest trickle of rickety boats washing up on British shores in the month before Brexit and since, Britain's government has begun to stoke an ugly culture war by linking asylum with danger and chaos, Connolly wrote. For a country that seeks to rebrand itself post-Brexit as an outward-looking champion of the rules-based international order, and a prime minister who seeks to distance himself from the recently unseated US president and his xenophobia, it is a parochial and authoritarian run. Amnesty International UK recently demanded British officials stop Patel's plan from coming to fruition and ensure the country meets its obligations to receive refugees. Davies said ministers must put an end to this and instead commit to ensuring that people who seek asylum in this country are properly supported and their claims dealt with fully, fairly, and efficiently.
U.S. cruiser Vincennes. Bandar Abbas Airport, 9:30 a.m., July 3rd, 1988. 274 passengers of Flight 655 from Bandar Abbas to Dubai were waiting to board the plane. A child asked her mother how long it would take to fly between Bandar Abbas and Dubai. Her mother said, less than an hour. The flight was scheduled to depart at 10 a.m., but the travelers were informed that the Airbus A300 flight had been delayed. 274 passengers and 16 crew members, 290 people in total. The Persian Gulf, near the Strait of Hormuz, 7:45 a.m., July 3rd, 1988. One of the helicopters of the U.S. cruiser, Vincennes, reports that Iranian boats are hovering around a German cargo vessel. The Vincennes cruiser moves quickly towards the German cargo vessel without being asked.
We remain alert and we'll stay alert. But at the same time, I don't want to ever give the impression that we're leaning forward on our toes to get a major conflagration started here. That's not the case at all.
The war that the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein started on the last day of the summer of 1980 against Iran entered its eighth year. Throughout these years, the Iranians wanted to put an end to the war through winning the land war. From the second year of the war onwards, they had been always far superior to the Iraqi army on the battlefield after being surprised by the beginning of the war. Operation Karbala 5 took place in early 1987. At the end of the bloody Operation Karbala 5, Iran had a superior position and was able to penetrate through the defensive line of Shalamche. The progress of Iranian forces towards Basra resulted in significant outcomes. The United States sent the aircraft carrier USS John F. Kennedy to the Persian Gulf to prevent the defeat of Iraq and the fall of Basra. Die Welt and Spiegel wrote that the United States was ready to fight Iran with 6 battalions and 600 warplanes in the event of the collapse of Basra. The Soviet Union also expressed its concern over the continuation of the war and stressed that the war had to be eventually ended with negotiated settlements. Perhaps the Iranians will never forget the statement of the Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger. Weinberger said, "Iranian people should be exterminated by cutting off Iran's oil production so that the war will be over." And years later, Secretary General of the United Nations, Javier Perez de Cuellar, wrote in his memoirs, "Following the adoption of Resolution 598 in July 1987, the United States definitely believed in order to end the war, 1. The Iraqis had to firmly stand against Iran's victory. 2. The war had to be more painful for Iranians than any other time. 3. The flow of weapons to Iran had to be reduced through another resolution within the Security Council. And 4. There had to be a great deal of international pressure on this country." In 1987, the Persian Gulf was the scene of the confrontation between Iran and the United States of America, in which many heartbreaking and painful incidents took place. In the spring of 1988, Iran was going through a tough situation. After the fall of Al-Fah, the U.S. government announced that it would support not only Kuwaiti and Saudi ships, but also other countries' ships and, in general, shipping in the Persian Gulf. They officially announced that all Iranian leaders had to know that the continuation of attacks in the Persian Gulf would not be tolerated.
On the morning of July the 3rd, we were coming back through the Straits of Hormuz on the way to pick up another ship for an Ernest Will escort mission. And there was some radio communications indicating sounds of explosions or such coming from Montgomery and Vincennes.
German merchant Ulagari, this is U.S. Navy warship. We are standing by channel 1-6. Over.
Yeah, okay, 1-6. Do you read me?
Merchant Ulagari, this is U.S. Navy warship. We need you loud and clear. Over.
Okay, thank you.
On the morning of July 3rd, Captain McKenna, chief of the U.S. Naval Operations Center, was startled to discover that Vincennes' cruiser had moved away about 64 kilometers from where it was supposed to be. Then he promptly ordered Vincennes and Montgomery back south to their original location.
It was our concern, however, that Vincennes was acting in an overly aggressive fashion, or so it seemed, and that they were actually pursuing these boats rather than being pursued by them. The IRGC were sort of a ragamuffin band, if you will. I mean, they were not very well coordinated, and certainly it wouldn't be too difficult to scare them, I don't think, into doing something that was foolhardy. If they saw a lot of military machinery bearing down on them, they could easily become frightened. It was our business out there to defend shipping against those guys, but not to provoke them. We don't know how close to the boats the helicopter actually went. There was, without getting too technical, a fixed distance that they were supposed to maintain. If, in fact, they were harassing the boats, which may have been the case, how would the boats communicate with them? Well, they would generally fire warning shots. We'd seen that happen with news helicopters there in the past. If the news helicopters or the media helicopters got too close to Iranian small boats, bog hammers, if you will, or whatever, warning shots would be fired and had been fired in the past.
An American helicopter pilot informed William Rogers, the commanding officer of Vincennes, that Iranian gunboats had fired at his helicopter. Rogers ignored the return order move towards Iranian territorial waters and convince Captain McKenna to authorize him to shoot Iranian boats. At 9:49, the Vincents opened fire on Iranian boats.
Zero is inbound.
350 relative.
Relative. Still inbound.
The warning shots, or were they actually attacked? The helicopter wasn't hit, after all. And the helicopter could escape the area at great speed, and in fact it did. So, therefore, what was Vincennes up to in going to general quarters, accelerating to maximum speed, and heading off to those boats, which at the time presented no threat to anyone?
I did not send the Vincennes to support the Montgomery. I authorized the Vincennes to send their helo. I was the only one that was in authority to send them anywhere, and my understanding was that they had asked permission to cover the area with the helicopter and that they were also told to remain on station. Benjamin at the time specified, and they were very clear-cut, that you will return fire with fire. And so they asked permission to take the units under fire. I gave permission and reported the same to Commander of Mideast Force.
In Bandar Abbas Airport, 274 passengers of Flight 655 from Bandar Abbas to Dubai boarded the plane so that pilot Mohsen Rezaian and his colleagues would fly them to Dubai. The Airbus, a passenger plane, took off at 10:16 after a short delay and was supposed to land at Dubai Airport in 28 minutes.
During that engagement with the small boats, the aircraft lifts off from Bandar Abbas and then proceeds on course, essentially, slightly off schedule, as has been noted. I think they were 20 minutes or so behind schedule, climbing on a fixed course, using the proper IFF and so forth and so on.
The Vincennes sailed into Iran's territorial waters in pursuit of Iranian boats by 10:22. And violated maritime law.
Officer deck, presently hold the ship, crossing the Iranian declared war zone line.
We did take the 12-mile limit seriously. Everybody was very concerned about it. Incurring into the 12-mile limit was verboten, and people were supposed to hold short of this 12-mile limit by several miles to prevent that from happening.
Aircraft was proceeding on a course that would take it directly over the Vincennes position. Recall again that Vincennes was in the middle of a gun battle with these small boats. Now, perhaps a battle of its own making, but firing nonetheless.
When I briefed in with the commander of the Mideast Force, I know that a very serious concern of his, as a matter of fact, he said, Dick, the one thing that I am concerned about is shooting down a civilian aircraft.
The Iranian passenger plane was ascending when the Vincennes crew saw it on the radar screen. The Airbus A300 passenger aircraft did not look like the F-14 Tomcat. A passenger plane is much larger compared to a fighter plane, and it also flies slower. However, the Vincennes crew believed that they had mistaken this giant plane for a tiny F-14 Tomcat.
I was told that it was an F-14. I watched it. I took a look at its altitude and its speed. It was climbing. It was slow. It was in the middle of our missile envelope. The F-14, to my knowledge, had no significant anti-surface warfare capability, so I designated this thing in my own mind as a non-threat. Captain Rogers, on the other hand, involved with his gun battle at that time, announces that he is intent on taking that aircraft out at 20 miles. It's climbing. It's slow. It doesn't respond. It's in the middle of our missile envelope, basically. It's vulnerable. Why would this aircraft present a threat that did not meet any of the threat parameters that were? If Captain Rogers believed it was a military aircraft, And if he believed, as we think he did, that it was part of a coordinated effort at that point, a coordinated attack, then in his mind, he could see this as a threat.
Tense. It did make the situation much more complicated.
Both ships had attempted to communicate with the aircraft, and we were unsuccessful. We got no response back.
We could hear the challenges go out on military air distress and the civilian version of the air distress channels. So we were aware that they were warning an aircraft, an approaching aircraft.
Typically, if you could not communicate with an Iranian airplane, military aircraft, you illuminated them with your fire control radar, you let them know that you were there, and they would generally depart the area. When we illuminated it with our fire control radar, it didn't react.
I did not have the capability to talk directly to the commanding officer of Vincennes, simply because he was engaged on a very personal basis in a fight. And I knew they were about ready to pull a trigger on a missile that could kill my pilots. And I wanted to make absolutely certain that they didn't become the victim.
Air hostile at 004, true, 21 miles.
The aircraft crosses the 20-mile mark. And he doesn't shoot it down. At that point, I breathed a sigh of relief, thinking that, okay, he has now seen that it is a non-threat.
Size is right here?
Size.
Okay.
What I'm told transpired during that period of time afterwards is that they weren't capable of getting the shot off in an orderly fashion. So although the intent was to shoot it down at 20 miles, they sort of bungled the operation.
William Rogers, the commanding officer of Vincennes, requested a permission from the command center to open fire on the Iranian fighter jet. The soldiers and crew members of the Vincennes cruiser became increasingly nervous when they heard about a possible attack by the Iranian fighter jet, and fear fell upon them all. The Iranian passenger plane was ascending, though a fighter jet does not need to get high to attack an aircraft, and it is capable of attacking the target so quickly. The passenger plane sent the codes that indicated it was not a fighter aircraft, and they could identify the aircraft based on the communications between the pilot and the watchtower. However, the commanding officer of Vincennes said they received no codes from the passenger plane, so that he decided to shoot down the plane. A few minutes later, 18th minute into the flight, the passenger plane disappeared from the Vincennes radar screen, and the crew of the American cruiser started embracing each other. They did not know that their happiness would soon fade away, and that was the bitterest day of their lives, the bitterness of which would always remain in their minds. A few meters away, there were 108 women and children among the 290 people who were killed. An eyewitness says, while collecting the bodies of the passengers, we saw a woman who had hugged her child. She was hugging her so tight, the baby was stuck in her arms. We would not separate them. A child who had thought it would take less than half an hour to get off the plane at Dubai Airport.
We had individuals who were up in places where they could see wreckage fall and they could see the airplane coming down. It wasn't until sometime later that they described the wreckage in terms that led us to believe that it was not a military aircraft. It was too much, too large.
An Iranian Airbus is presumed crashed. Please look for survivors or aircraft wreckage.
I killed over the entire force. They spent a considerable amount of time. There was nothing there. And it's also fairly ironic that the Vincennes is the one that came upon the wreckage when it started to become apparent that this was an airliner that was involved. It was just a sickening feeling for the entire rest of the day. I can't ever remember being so dismayed, so depressed, so feeling for all of the people that were involved. It wasn't a very happy day in the Gulf for us, that's for sure. The Sides was dispatched to go close to Dubai to see if they could find wreckage.
Firstly, the Americans announced that they had shot down an Iranian F-14 Tomcat. And once the truth came out, they claimed that the Iranian plane had deviated from the flight path and had ignored all 7 radio warnings issued from the Vincents. Later on, it became clear that the Iranian plane was ascending along a legal flight path. 4 years after the incident, the New York Times wrote, "It was a Vincent's cruiser that illegally crossed into Iranian territorial waters. However, American officials have covered it up."
After receiving further data and evaluating information available from the Persian Gulf, we believe that the cruiser USS Vincennes, while actively engaged with threatening Iranian surface units and protecting itself from what was concluded to be a hostile aircraft, shot down an Iranian airliner over the Straits of Hormuz. The U.S. government deeply regrets this incident. Given the threatening flight profile and the decreasing range, the aircraft was declared hostile. Vincennes fired 2 standard surface-to-air missiles, at least one of which hit at an approximate range of 6 miles. An examination of the events on 3 July leads quickly to the conclusion that Iran must share the responsibility for tragedy and the investigation so found. By any measure, it was unconscionable to ignore the repeated warnings of the United States and permit an airliner to take off from a joint military-civilian airfield and fly directly into the midst of the ongoing surface action in the Strait of Hormuz, which the Iranians themselves had initiated.
The United Nations Security Council, July 16, 1988. An emergency meeting was held at the request of the Iranian representative to the United Nations to review the incident of the passenger plane being shot down. Iran's foreign minister and U.S. representative George W. Bush spoke at the meeting. Bush told Mr. Velayati, "This would not have happened if you had stopped fighting the war." He continued, "Minister, I am telling you that you need to choose between ending the war and confronting us. The war had become painfully torturous for the Iranians, and Resolution 598 was accepted 2 days after the Security Council meeting and the Airbus incident. On July 20th, 2 days after the adoption of the United Nations Security Council resolution on the crash of a passenger aircraft, a resolution was issued. A resolution that only expressed regret about the occurrence of that incident and included a few general statements in its other paragraphs. It also contains some recommendations concerning the prevention of future incidents and supporting research by the International Civil Aviation Organization. Iran simultaneously requested an emergency meeting from the Security Council and asked the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO, to initiate the investigations. However, the final report of the ICAO was nothing beyond the Security Council's statement. They condemned the incident and offered some ethical recommendations.
Everybody interviewed in the combat center said that the plane was descending toward the Vincennes. But the electronic record shows it never descended toward the Vincennes. But everybody had that view. I mean, they totally deluded themselves as to the nature of the threat.
Later on, Iranians filed a formal complaint with the International Court of Justice at The Hague. The results of the Security Council meeting and the ICAO investigations had already shown that there would be no better ending to this case in The Hague as well.
Perhaps at the time of the ICAO release, we should have declassified the ship's position and issued a press release pointing out Vincennes' location within Iranian waters at the time of firing.
I spent an immense amount of time, probably the bulk of my time, looking at all the tracks and the various documentation that had been done on the tracks, and how uncertain that evidence is.
How do you explain, Admiral, the discrepancy that everything started in response to distress calls, and yet the Fogarty report later confirmed that it turned out that there were no distress calls?
I don't think I can explain, Congressman. I think he misspoke.
Mr. Fogarty?
Yes. I've talked to him about it. He doesn't remember it. I cannot reconcile it.
The reason why there was no final report is exclusively my fault. We didn't produce any further document, although we wanted to, and I got bogged down with something else that erupted. I forget what it was. The biggest problem you have in doing any investigation is the guy who commits the mistake, or whether it be an honest error or whether it be a grievous error, lies to his superiors to cover his own butt.
The commanding officer and crew members of the Vincennes cruiser received the U.S. Navy Medal of Honor once they completed their mission in the Persian Gulf. The passenger plane's case was closed after the agreement. However, history still remembers it, and every year people honor the memory of the travelers who never arrived at their destination.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
One local risk assessment specialist said the building's collapse could be a canary in the coal mine type event as sea levels rise, says Brett Wilkins, writer, in an article published under the heading, Experts Warn, Florida Tower Disaster is Climate Emergency Wake-Up Call. Stay tuned for more. And the search for answers following recently disintegration of a high-rise condominium tower near Miami, some experts are cautiously pointing to the climate emergency as a possible culprit, or, at the very least, a risk multiplier in the disaster, underscoring the need for urgent climate and infrastructure action. With 11 confirmed deaths and 150 people still missing following the partial collapse of Champlain Tower South in Surfside on June 24th, Rescuing survivors and retrieving victims' bodies remain authorities' top priority. However, officials and expats have also begun the long and daunting task of determining what caused the building to fail. A 2018 engineering report on the 12-story tower noted design flaws and major structural damage, including a deteriorating roof, defective waterproofing, and crumbling concrete columns, and rusting rebar in the building's underground garage. The report warned that some of these problems could cause exponential damage in the future. With so much well-documented existing damage and with repairs to the building underway at a time it disintegrated, experts have been reluctant to attribute the collapse to any single cause. However, numerous scientists and other experts say that rising sea levels and more intense tidal flooding related to the climate emergency could have played a significant role in the disaster. There is little doubt among experts that a warming planet due to human activity is causing sea levels rise, and it is certain that rising waters can infiltrate the porous limestone upon the southeastern Florida building's stand, potentially degrading their foundations over time. As a 5.9-inch rise in local sea levels and 320% surge in nuisance flooding in the area since mid-1990s attests, Metro Miami is particularly susceptible to the consequences of the climate emergency. Last year, a report from Resources for the Future, a Washington, D.C.-based think tank, stated that Miami is one of the most at-risk cities in the world from the damages caused by coastal flooding and storms. Atorod Azizi Nami, who directs the Master School of Construction, Infrastructure, and Sustainability at Florida International University, FIU, told the Palm Beach Post that climate change can play a role in disasters like the Champlain Tower South collapse. It can cause settlement of the ground with sea level rise and corrosion. Zhang Renpeng, director of the International Center for Adaptation Planning and Design at the University of Florida, told the Palm Beach Post that sea level rise does cause potential corrosion, and if that was happening, it's possible it could not handle the weight of the building. "I think this could be a wake-up call for coastal developments," warned Peng. Albert Slapp, chief executive of the Boca Raton, Florida-based construction risk assessment company Risk Footprint, explained to the Washington Post that groundwater enters the pores of the concrete and ultimately weakens it and erodes it. So the foundations are subject to a lot of geological forces that could compact the soil underneath. It could cause voids. We just don't know. Slapp said the Champlain Tower South disaster could be a canary in the coal mine type event. "It's not just one building," he added. "This could be something that could affect other buildings." Climate scientists predict an acceleration in sea level rise in southeastern Florida with a projected increase of 10 to 17 inches by 2040, 21 to 54 inches by 2070, and 40 to 136 inches by 2120. Land subsidence, the sudden sinking or gradual settling of the ground surface, is also linked to the climate.